Case this morning is Fluker versus County of Kankakee.
May it please the court. I am Greg Olmstead. I represent Roy Fluker Jr. and his wife, Deborah Fluker. The basis of this appeal is the application of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, PLRA.
Could I start you out with a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
How would the Flukers go about exhausting his administrative remedies at this point? The manual provides only for exhaustion by current inmates. He's no longer at the jail. He was there for approximately a month after the incident, and he did not file a grievance and has yet, it seems to me, to offer reason for a delay of that length. Why would that not be the end of the case?
Yes, Your Honor. The facts of the case are such that the manual I would submit is has ambiguity as to the inmate having to be actually currently an inmate to bring a grievance. I do not see anywhere in the terms, and the terms are very brief. It's at docket 15-4. It's less than one page, the inmate grievance procedures. These administrative procedures are at best simple, and they do not suggest whatsoever that you have to be a current inmate. And more importantly, the grievance procedures do not in any way suggest that there is any time limit to those procedures. So it's open-ended. This is drafted by the Chief of Corrections for the defendants. Any ambiguity, of course, would be construed against the drafter of such a policy. And, Your Honor, I think the gist of our case is that counsel for the defendants suggests that there's a procedural default because, as Your Honor suggested, he's no longer a prisoner. There's no case law directly on point for such an inmate as Mr. Fluker. And on top of that, and we're not making any excuse, Your Honor, that that the grievance had not been filed. That's not our intent at all. We are simply saying the defendants did not bring the PLRA to the court until the close of fact discovery. They took the plaintiff's deposition in March of 2012. Not a single question was asked about any grievance procedure, any pursuit of any administrative remedies whatsoever. And then we went through the full gamut of discovery. And again, nothing at all was brought up about the grievance procedure, any administrative remedies. It is not the plaintiff's...
How far along were you at that time?
Your Honor, it was the close of discovery that this affirmative defense was granted, leave to file this was granted to the defendants. At that point, it is our position that the district court had no discretion whatsoever to... The court had to bring everything to a stop at that point and say, okay, I have the PLRA in front of me, and now I have to decide that. And I have to decide that and nothing else. And the district court, sua sponte, should have taken that course. However, the court put the onus on the plaintiff. The court says, well, the plaintiff needed to say that, you know, we want to stay the matter to conduct discovery on this. The fact of the matter is we do not dispute that no grievance had been filed. That is not disputed at all. So what discovery would there be to conduct? And I will say that the fact that is relied upon for the application of the PLRA in this case is the affidavit of the Chief of Corrections, which says, I'm the one that decides the grievance. I'm the one that has all the information from the inmate's file whether a grievance had been filed, and no grievance had been filed. Again, this affidavit is brought at the close of discovery. And that affidavit was available to the defendants, the content of that affidavit, from the beginning of the litigation.
If the court had dismissed the case without prejudice, though, you're claiming it was with prejudice, but if it had been without prejudice, where does it get you? The statute of limitations is run. Your client is no longer in the correctional facility where he could file a grievance. What do you have at that point?
Well, we submit, Your Honor, that we do have the procedural, under their grievance procedures, to bring the administrative remedies to the jail officials and to have that exhausted. And then, without prejudice, we could refile the action. And the whole point is that a reconstituted action upon refiling then would be the action that would be subject to a decision on the merits.
But didn't you get a decision on the merits anyway?
Well, that's the whole point. Once the court decided that it was appropriate to bring the PLRA into the case at the point that it was brought, at the end of fact discovery, the court had no discretion. The court had to say, I am going to decide this issue, and that will be the end of this.
But ultimately, in real terms, you got a decision on the merits by the district court after full discovery.
Well, we're saying that that was an impermissible advisory opinion because the court had to construe and find only on the basis of the PLRA. That's the whole purpose of the statute. The purpose of the statute is to avoid the protracted litigation that was conducted. And the only reason the litigation was conducted because the PLRA defense was not brought.
But if what you want, which is a dismissal without prejudice, a remand so that you can undergo an administrative procedure, that gets dismissed because your client's no longer at the jail, then you refile your case. Discovery has been taken. There'll be a new motion for summary judgment, and the court's not going to decide it any differently because there's no new evidence.
Well, the point is, Your Honor, we believe that there would be new evidence. The record is such that we had also requested at the time we were asking that the case be, again, and the case had to be, in essence, dismissed in order to be refiled under the PLRA. We were asking that the case be voluntarily dismissed. And again, the court put the onus on us to do that when the court should have taken it upon itself to do that. And at that point, then, we would have had the right to file a new action, a refiled action, bringing new allegations. One of the allegations that we wanted to bring was a state law claim for ordinary negligence for the driving of the correctional officer on a respondeat superior basis.
Don't you have a pending state law claim right now?
Well, that pending state law claim is subject to being dismissed for res judicata purposes and such. So we only did that in an abundance of caution for our client and filed that. But there are some serious concerns about that because of res judicata and such. The whole point is that we should have never gotten to this point with the PLRA being introduced into the case. The court did not have to allow that to be introduced. The court exercised its discretion. We say that it was impermissible to do that. However, the court did it, and we're not appealing that. We're just appealing that once you decided to bring it in, then you have to decide that issue and that issue alone without prejudice. Perez states such, and it's the law of this that decided by this court in 1999, and it hasn't been changed since. There was no deference to that law in the district court's opinion. And again, I have to emphasize, had there been some time limit on the administrative remedies, had there been a time limit such as the Perez case, there was a time limit under administrative law in Wisconsin. Other cases that are cited in this action, I think the Pozo case, also a time limit under administrative law. There are also other cases cited where it was a federal facility, so there were federal regulations that applied with a time limit. We do not have any such time limit, any deadline in this case. It's an open-ended grievance process, and it has not been exhausted. The only reason it has not been exhausted is Admittedly, the plaintiff did not seek to exhaust it initially, but the plaintiff has not lost that right. The plaintiff is still wanting to pursue that right and has every a right to do so to exhaust his administrative remedies and then file a reconstituted action, which would be within theories, no new parties, within theories that would be proper for the action that had already been filed. No statute of limitations issues. However, we would ask on remand that the statute of limitation, that the plaintiff certainly not be prejudiced by a statute of limitations which was only allowed to expire because of the court's, the district court's ruling. And I must say that in our case, we had filed the action early on. We were operating in a two-year statute of limitations. The defense allowed the this PLRA defense to be raised after the 1 year, technically 1 year statute of limitations for any state law issues that would be subject to Illinois Tort Immunity Act limitations. And then now they're saying that, well, the plaintiff is out of luck because the plaintiff is no longer an inmate. And we made various arguments to the district court. The plaintiff was there for 25 days after his cervical spine fractures that resulted in fusion surgery. He was only at that facility for another 25 days. And we're not even using that as an excuse for the failure to file for the administrative remedies. We're just saying the plaintiff, in reviewing the process, the procedure of the defendants, had no way of knowing that there's any limit, any time limit whatsoever, any deadline. Nowhere does it state that there's any deadline for you to pursue your administrative remedies. That's the crux of our appeal. And we would ask that the case be, the dismissal be modified to be without prejudice, that the plaintiff be allowed to pursue administrative remedies, that the plaintiff then exhaust those administrative remedies, and as the PLRA requires, then refile a reconstituted action against these same defendants, and with any other allegations that the plaintiff chooses to make at that point that would be in the original two-year statute of limitations. Again, we do not see how the plaintiff can be prejudiced here on a statute of limitations that the defendants allowed the plaintiff to run up to by keeping this PLRA defense in its back pocket and bringing it out at the last moment. So the emphasis that we have is, again, no deadline under administrative remedies. We still have the viable right to pursue those remedies, and we are asking that we have right to do so and to bring a refiled action on that basis, satisfying the PLRA, and then getting to the merits of the reconstituted action that we'll file. And that would be subject to some changes in the allegations. That was the whole point. The court did not have any basis to be making any decision on the merits in this case. And that's why we have not even pursued an appeal on the merits. It was impermissible. Again, under Perez, it says it's an impermissible advisory opinion. If your honors have no further questions at this point, I will defer to the defendants.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bersani.
Good morning, your honors. Mike Bersani, along with my co-counsel, Jason Rose, on behalf of the defendant appellees, County of Kankakee, and the Sheriff's Office. May it please the court. I'd first like to address Judge Rovner's question about the handbook and counsel's response to that. Page 1 of the inmate handbook clearly spells out that the rules are applicable to all inmates confined at the jail for the period of time for which they are under in the legal custody of the sheriff. And then if you go further on into the handbook at page 21, inmate is defined as a confined person. Then if you look at the grievance procedures outlined in the inmate handbook, they're all tailored around a process of addressing grievances by inmates confined at the facility. They have to use a grievance form supplied by the jail. Yes, Judge. I look like
I know,
you have a question.
It's impossible for me to keep it to myself.
Yeah.
I'm troubled by the argument that he can't file a grievance because he's no longer
right.
at the prison, and that his failure to exhaust dooms his claim. Because are you contending that the prison may immunize itself from litigation by simply transferring an inmate before he has an opportunity to file a grievance? In other words, can the prison purposely injure a prisoner, for instance, and then just move him immediately to another prison and claim failure to exhaust? Because my reading of our cases would indicate that there's no need to exhaust when exhaustion is unavailable, and moving makes, you know, moving the prisoner makes exhaustion unavailable.
I have a few responses to that. The statute states that the inmate has to grieve, has to follow the internal procedures that are available, and they must exhaust those available procedures. So under your scenario, if the inmate's injured today and the prison decides to move the inmate tomorrow, then maybe the inmate would have an argument under those circumstances that the procedures were not available to him. And that would have nothing to do with the inmate's own doing, the inmate's own neglect in not following the procedures. But that's not the case we have here. The case we have here is that the inmate had almost 30 days to file a grievance after the injury, and the plaintiff has conceded on appeal that those procedures were available to him during that time period. So there's no question on appeal. There's no dispute that those procedures were available to Roy Fluker immediately after his injury and for the time period that he was confined. Nor is there any evidence or any argument that the jail moved this inmate in order to do as Your Honor suggested, which is to prevent the inmate from following the procedure.
Scenario.
So under the circumstances we have in this case, Roy Fluker had the opportunity, had available procedures to him to grieve the incident and whatever claims he had, and he failed to follow that. And well, that is a procedural default. That is his failing. That is his fault. That is his neglect. The plaintiff can't use the PLRA as a sword. It's a shield that the defense has, not a sword that the plaintiff has. And so the plaintiff can't somehow use that as an excuse. Well, I'm not going to follow the procedures that the jail has, and I'm going to later say, well, now I want to go back and follow them, even though I'm not an inmate there anymore. It doesn't make any sense.
Isn't pending Seventh Circuit law such that any dismissal based on a failure of exhaustion of the PLRA has to be without prejudice?
The statement in Ford versus Johnson, for example, says that. However, even in Ford and even before Ford and even after Ford, the Seventh Circuit case law states that dismissal for failure to exhaust is without prejudice and does not bar reinstatement unless it is too late to exhaust. So there is that caveat there. Now, Ford didn't involve the facts that we have here, obviously, where you have an inmate who has been transferred to another facility and can no longer exhaust because he's not an inmate at our facility any longer. So that caveat didn't really come into play.
Is there any way that any procedure that can't be a rare occurrence where a grieving inmate may be moved, is there any procedure that if he's not on your facility?
No. There is not under the jail rules that currently exist, which the Supreme Court has said and this court said in Pozo, the inmate has to follow the rules, has to exhaust the remedies at the place and the time prescribed by the jail. So the jail, so the courts have given the jails a great deal of deference in dealing with inmate grievances, in setting up the regulations and rules that inmates are to follow in complaining about jail conditions. And so in this instance here, this jail has decided that it's not going to entertain grievances by inmates who are no longer confined at its facility. And again, as I said earlier, if the reason why the inmate cannot exhaust the remedies is because of something the jail did, that's a different story. But if the reason why the inmate cannot exhaust the remedies is because of the inmate's own neglect in following those procedures, Well, that's where the caveat in Ford and Pozo and Walker versus Thompson and Burrell and Phillips and all these other cases kicks in.
Was he transferred shortly after he got out of the hospital?
Shortly, it depends what you mean by shortly, but it was about almost 30 days after the hospital. I think he was in the hospital 3 days, I believe, and so it was about 3 weeks, almost 4 weeks after he got out of the hospital. But again, Your Honor, there's no argument by the plaintiff here. In fact, the plaintiff has conceded that the procedures were available to his client during that time period. On top of that, even if he wasn't conceding that, the district court judge rejected all those arguments that the plaintiff had made in response to summary judgment that the procedures were not available as not being meritorious arguments, and the plaintiff has never appealed that portion of the district court's opinion. So there's a waiver there as well.
This is just out of curiosity. You have a substantial contract with the federal government about moving prisoners to this facility, right?
Yes.
Is there any difference in the procedures that you follow with federal prisoners as opposed to state prisoners?
No, not at all. We treat them all like the federal and as well as,
I mean,
as well
the federal as government did not insist that you do something.
No, not at all. This jail also takes inmates from Cook County, and both the federal government and Cook County leave it up to this particular jail to enforce their own internal grievance procedures.
Does sure. any local law require the passengers in a van wear a seatbelt?
No.
No?
No. No. The law has changed since this incident. Now, Illinois law is front backseat passengers have to wear seatbelts, but as it currently existed at the time, there was no statutory requirement or even local requirement that passengers in transport vans have to be seatbelted.
Mr. Kluger is still in jail, so is it your position that that Kankakee has never allowed a federal prisoner still in jail to file a grievance at the holding facility he was at before he, in federal custody before he got transferred to a federal penitentiary? He can't file the form?
He could have filed the form while he was still in our custody.
Right, but now that he's
out,
still
cannot.
In custody in a federal facility elsewhere, you will not accept a grievance from
no. him? No, it's too late. I mean, our rules provide that the grievance procedure is for inmates that are confined at our facility. And it makes sense. There's practical reasons. I mean, it's the inmates there. The inmate can be interviewed. Witnesses can be interviewed. There can be that back and forth investigation if one's necessary. If you can consider the chaos administratively, if the jail had to entertain grievances for inmates who flouted our own rules, went off to another facility 6 months, a year, 2 years later, and now we have to track down those inmates because now they've decided to file a grievance. Now our jail has to devote resources to trying to interview that person, interview witnesses. It becomes chaotic, and the Supreme Court said, and this court said in Pozo, Supreme Court said in Woodford, that the jail's entitled to orderly structure to its administrative rules on grievances. And this is part of the orderly structure here, is that we're only going to entertain grievances by inmates who are currently incarcerated at our facility.
Has anything about the handbook been changed since this case was filed?
No.
Nothing?
As it relates to grievances, no. No, it's been the same procedure for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I wanted to address the Perez argument just real quickly here because it's one of the focal points of the plaintiff's appeal. The district court properly filed Perez. You know, Perez involved a situation where the district court skipped over the defendant's PLRA exhaustion defense, didn't address it, and addressed the case on the merits. That's not the case here. Judge McCuskey did exactly what this court said to do in Perez, address the exhaustion defense first. And that's what the district court did. Now, Judge McCuskey decided to also alternatively address the merits of the case, and there's nothing in Perez that prevents that compound approach at all. In fact, it makes sense because the district court judge doesn't know how this court's going to feel about the decision on the PLRA defense. And so it just makes a lot of sense, and it's a proper exercise of the court's discretion in doing so. I wanted to also address the issue of the amendment to the complaint because I think it's In this particular case, when Roy Fluker initially filed his lawsuit about 3 or 4 months after the incident, he only sued the sheriff and the county, did not sue any individuals. And so we had a scheduling, 16B scheduling conference with Master Judge Bernthal, in which we agreed upon dates for scheduling, for discovery, and for amendment of pleadings. This was an agreed-upon date, March 9, 2012, in which the parties were to amend pleadings. Now, the plaintiff did amend his pleadings by that date, but all the plaintiff did was add his wife as a plaintiff, as an additional plaintiff, and add a consortium claim. Did not add any individuals, did not add a negligence claim. And it wasn't until about 6 months later that the plaintiff, in response to our PLRA defense, said, you know what, I want to amend the complaint now. Judge Bernthal said, no, you can't do that. It's too late. You haven't shown good cause to amend the complaint. The plaintiff never filed an objection with Judge McCuskey as to that decision, which would be required under Rule 72. And furthermore, the plaintiff on appeal has not challenged that decision at all. It wasn't until after the defendants filed for summary judgment that the plaintiff decided to actually file a motion to amend the complaint to add individual defendants and to add a negligence count. And Judge McCuskey properly exercised his discretion in denying that motion. There had been too much delay in the meantime. There was no explanation as to why the plaintiff waited so long to add individual defendants and to add a negligence claim. There was a lot of prejudice to the defendants because we conducted discovery based upon the pleadings we had before us. And on top of that, there's a futility argument that we made as it related to the state law claims because contrary to counsel's argument, there is a one-year statute of limitations in suing individual public employees under the Illinois Tort Immunity Act, not 2 years. And so even if he would have been allowed to amend his complaint, even after we filed for summary judgment, that amendment would have been futile because it would have been barred, the suit against the individuals would have been barred by the statute of limitations.
But why did the county wait so long to claim the failure to exhaust? That defense was available immediately, but you sat on your rights.
Yes, that is true. Judge mea culpa, it was an oversight on our part. We didn't assert it right away. Now, we did assert it when the county's motion to dismiss was denied and we had an opportunity to file an answer on behalf of the county. We immediately asserted the affirmative defense, and then we moved for leave to file it on behalf of the sheriff. So there was some delay in asserting that defense. However, the delay was not prejudicial to the plaintiff, which is what Judge Bernthal found. Fact discovery was still ongoing. In fact, we had conversations with counsel about the fact that if he wanted to file an agreed motion to extend discovery for him to do any discovery on the exhaustion defense, we would not oppose that. Counsel never took us up on that. Judge Bernthal said to counsel, if you need additional discovery on the exhaustion defense, you need to ask for it. Plaintiff never took Judge Bernthal up on that particular offer. And so while at first glance it may seem that the defendants, had delayed in bringing that defense, and that may have some relevance here, it really is a red herring because there was no prejudice to the plaintiff at all. The plaintiff did not object to Judge Bernthal's decision allowing us to file that defense. And the plaintiff has not appealed that decision to this court, so there's a waiver of that. So it really is a red herring.
Isn't the prejudice argument, though, if it had been raised by you earlier, he could have gone in and asked to have the complaint dismissed. You would have raised it. He could have asked to have it voluntarily dismissed, or it could have been dismissed without prejudice. I don't know if the timing was proper at that time, but was he still at Kankakee?
No, he wasn't. He filed his complaint in September. He was transferred out of Kankakee in mid-July. So, he could have voluntarily dismissed his case at any time early in the case. I mean, he knew the PLRA defense existed out there. We just hadn't asserted it yet, but it's not a secret. But as I said, it's really a red herring because he hasn't challenged that decision on appeal at all. If there's no further questions, Your Honor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Thank you.
Respectfully, there is nothing in the record as to any deadline or any time limit for the plaintiffs to pursue their administrative remedies. No matter how many different ways counsel wants this court to look at the grievance procedures, it's just not in there. Unlike Pozo, unlike all the other cases, where it's in there.
Purpose. These rules are applicable to all inmates confined at the JCDC for the entire period that you are in the facility's legal custody and apply to time spent outside the facility for, well, whatever. So that it can't be. You're saying that can't
Well, what I'm saying is that, again, that has nothing to do with filing a grievance procedure. I think that what that pertains to is in order to have a grievance, you have had to have been an inmate. That's how the plaintiffs read that particular provision. Of course, that's the case. Again, there's nothing in here that says after you leave our facility, you no longer have any right to file a grievance. Again, this is what the Chief of Corrections himself is of the record. This is what he drafted. We'll make it specific so the inmate understands exactly where he stands. And if he has any particular time limit, which he, under these terms he does not, certainly if you're asserting that he does, well, then inform him of that in writing. And counsel says it was too late. There's nothing, again, in here that says it's too late. And then counsel brings up the question of, well, how about other actions being brought by amendment? And what I had stated to you is that the amendment would be in terms of a respondeat superior allegation for negligent driving. That's an amendment that's permissible. It's not barred by any statute of limitations. It's not an amendment as to other parties. It's an amendment as to a theory of liability. There would be no bar of any limitations. However, I am asking that on remand that the plaintiff not be prejudiced by any statute of limitations because of what the district court decided in deciding to go ahead with the merits decision after ruling that the PLRA was essentially a bar to the action.
The PLRA participated in the merits decision, didn't you? You filed an opposing brief and addressed it substantively, is that correct?
At that point, Your Honor, from our perspective, we had no choice. We had to do that. We weren't going to leave it without making a sufficient record. However, I will say that we had asked that it be voluntarily dismissed, and that was not allowed.
Did you challenge it on appeal, the substantive ruling of the court on the merits?
No, we did not, because we're saying that that was not permissible. You never get there under these facts. You simply never get there. Perez says that. There's no if, ands, or buts. That's what Perez stands for.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.